Blog Talk Radio.
Came from the buffalo. Our teepees were made of buffalo hides. So were our clothes and moccasins. We ate buffalo meat. The buffalo were the life of the Kiowas.
The U.S. recognized that without the buffalo, the Plains nations could not survive and would have little choice but to remain on reservations and live off the meager government rations. White buffalo hunters with high-powered Sharps rifles were encouraged in, and the slaughter began.
Has the white man become a child that he should recklessly kill and not eat? When the Kiowa slay game, they do so that they may live and not starve. Daide, Kiowa.
The slaughter proceeded at an astonishing pace. Thousands of animals were killed every day.
The buffalo hunters have done more to settle the vexed Indian question than the entire regular army. For the sake of lasting peace, let them kill, skin, and sell until the buffaloes are exterminated. General Phil Sheridan, U.S. Army.
In a desperate struggle for survival, the Southern Plains nations went to war to save the buffalo. In the summer of 1874, thousands of Indian people flooded off the reservations. And in that moment of freedom, Setdaide and others led an allied Indian force in an attack on a buffalo hunter's camp at Adobe Walls, Texas. But they were no match for the hunters with their powerful buffalo guns. Defeat was followed by massive military expeditions by the United States Army to force the Southern Plains nations back onto reservations. In the fall, Setdaide was forced to surrender and was returned to the penitentiary at Huntsville, Texas. Later, it was reported that he had committed suicide by leaping out of a window. The Kiowa believed he was murdered.
They killed Setdaide. That's where I always thinking of the Kiowa people. They killed him. He didn't kill himself. He's too much of a man to do anything like that. It's too much of a chief. The chiefs don't do that.
By winter, all Kiowa bands had been forced back to the reservation. The following spring, the last of the Cheyennes surrendered, followed soon after by the last free Comanche. Determined to break the Southern Plains nations forever, the army rounded up 10,000 Indian horses. Almost 1,000 were shot. The rest sold at auction. By 1890, the buffalo population of 50 million had been reduced to fewer than 1,000. The war to save the buffalo and a way of life had been lost.
The Kiowas were camped on the north side of Mount Scott. Those of them who are still free to camp. One young woman got up very early in the morning. The dawn mist was still rising from Medicine Creek. And as she looked across the water, peering through the haze, she saw the last buffalo herd appear, like a spirit dream. Straight to Mount Scott, the leader of the herd walked. Behind him came the cows and their calves, and the few young males who had survived. As the woman watched, the face of the mountain opened. Inside Mount Scott, the world was green and fresh, as it had been when she was a small girl. The rivers ran clear, not red. The wild plums were in blossom, chasing the red buds up the inside slopes. Into this world of beauty, the buffalo walked, never to be seen again.
Sometimes at evening I sit looking out. The sun sets, and dust steals over the water. In the shadows I seem again to see our Indian village, with smoke curling upward from the lodges. And in the river's roar I hear the yells of the warriors, the laughter of the little children as of old. It is but an old woman's dream. Again, I see but shadows and hear only the roar of the river. And tears come into my eyes. Our Indian life, I know, is gone forever.
What treaty that the whites have kept has the red man broken? Not one. What treaty that the white man ever made with us have they kept? Not one. Sitting Bull, Hung Papa.
The northern plains mirrored the south, with Indian nations being driven onto reservations. Yet a handful of leaders refused to sign treaties and were determined to remain free at any cost. These defiant leaders became heroes to Indian people across the plains. Among them, two men from the Sioux Nations stood alone. One was the venerated Hung Papa holy man, Sitting Bull. The other was a young Oglala fighting man whose fierce military genius struck fear into his enemies and inspired fervent followers. His image would never be captured by photographers or artists, but his spirit of pride and resistance would be carried on by his people. His name was Crazy Horse. In the summer of 1876, thousands of Cheyenne, Arapaho, and people from many Sioux nations fled the reservations to join Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse in a great encampment along the Little Bighorn River in present-day Montana. The gathering, possibly the largest in Plains history, swelled to 8,000, with camp circles stretching for miles. The Indian people were well aware that this could be their last great celebration of freedom. There, far from any white settlements, they would hunt the last remaining buffalo, feast, race ponies, visit with old friends and relatives, and join in a massive sun dance that would be remembered for generations. On June 25th, 1876, as the United States prepared to celebrate 100 years of freedom, five companies of the 7th Cavalry under George Armstrong Custer advanced on Sitting Bull's camp. It was not until the dust from the 7th Cavalry rose over the hills that the startled encampment learned of the troops. Two Moons, leader of the Northern Cheyenne, was swimming in the creek.
I looked up the Little Horn towards Sitting Bull's camp. I saw a great dust rising. It looked like a whirlwind.
Women were screaming and men were letting out war cries. We could hear old men calling, "Soldiers are here! Young men, go out and fight them!"
Crazy Horse rode through the camp gathering his men as Custer's surprise attack stirred panic among the women and children.
Children were hunting for their mothers. Mothers were anxiously trying to find their children. The air was so full of dust I could not see where to go. Wooden Leg, Northern Cheyenne.
While the young men rode into battle, Sitting Bull rallied the men still in camp to protect the women and children. The Hunkpapa under Gaul and the Oglala under Crazy Horse quickly rode out and counterattacked.
Many hundreds of Indians on horseback were dashing to and fro in front of a body of soldiers. The soldiers were on the level valley ground and were shooting with rifles. Not many bullets were being sent back at them, but thousands of arrows were falling among them. Wooden Leg, Northern Cheyenne.
A big dust was whirling on the hill, and then the horses began coming out of it with empty saddles. Black Elk, Oglala.
The battle was over in less than half an hour. Custer, 260 men of the 7th Cavalry, and as many as 150 Indian people laid dead. Cheyenne survivors of the massacre of Black Kettle's people along the Washita River exulted in the death of Custer, the man they called Woman Killer. But that night, Sitting Bull was reflective.
My heart is full of sorrow that so many were killed on each side. But when they compel us to fight, we must fight. Tonight, we shall mourn for our dead and for those brave white men lying on the hillside. Sitting Bull, Hunkpapa.
The next day, firing the grass as cover, the Indian forces broke camp and headed toward the Bighorn Mountains. News of the battle reached the outside world on July 4th, 1876. Dampening a giddy U.S. centennial celebration. The next morning's newspapers, ignoring all evidence, called it a massacre.
We felt that it was a great battle, not a massacre. The soldiers were going to compel us to stay on our reservation and take away from us our country. We were trying to get away from them. Run's the enemy, Cuthead Sioux.
Outraged by what was seen as an affront to their national pride, the American public cried out for immediate reprisal. Punitive expeditions were sent out, mercilessly hunting down the last free bands of the Northern Plains. Sitting Bull's Hunkpapa escaped into Canada, where they received political asylum. Crazy Horse's Oglala took refuge in the Black Hills, where the full force of the United States Army was turned on them. For months, the Army was unable to defeat or capture the Oglala leader. Finally, the U.S. made peace overtures to Crazy Horse, promising land, generous subsidies, and protection if he and his starving people turned themselves in. On May 5th, 1877, after nearly a year of successfully eluding the all-out manhunt, Crazy Horse led nearly 1,000 followers to surrender at Camp Robinson. Oglala, already at the agency, lined the route, singing and cheering. One U.S. Army officer marveled that it was a triumphal march, not a surrender. The leader, who had known nothing but the freedom of the plains, was stripped of his horse and gun. Then, 4 months later, on September 5th, 1877. Believing he was going to a meeting with the commander of Fort Robinson, Crazy Horse was led past an armed guard to the doorway of a building. Inside was a small barred cell, 3 feet wide by 6 feet tall. Crazy Horse resisted. A soldier thrust a bayonet into his back. That night, as Crazy Horse lay dying, he told his father, "Tell the people, it is no use to count on me anymore." Crazy Horse was laid to rest near the creek called Wounded Knee.
As Americans or people in any free society, we cherish our independence and know that the cost to secure this hard-won commodity is often measured in human lives. Think for a moment, what would happen if your freedom was placed at risk? Is it any wonder then that Indian nations fought to preserve theirs? Now imagine the unthinkable, being conquered. You're forced onto barren land and have no choice but to live under the control of the conquering government. In this last hour, we'll take you to the reservations of the 1800s, to the stark, bitter truth about the loss of freedom. But first we go to the epic struggles of two impassioned leaders whose resourcefulness and daring are synonymous with courage. Leaders whose words remain among the most moving in the history of the world, Chief Joseph and Geronimo.
My father sent for me. I saw he was dying. I took his hand in mine. He said, "My son, never forget my dying words. This country holds your father's body. Never sell the bones of your father and your mother." I pressed my father's hand and told him I would protect his grave with my life. I buried him in that beautiful valley of winding waters. I loved that land more than all the rest of the world. Chief Joseph Les Perce.
Upon his father's death, 31-year-old Hinmutuyahlatkit, known as Chief Joseph, became head of a band of Nez Perce whose home was the Wallawa Valley, 250 miles east of present-day Portland, Oregon. Famed for their selective breeding of horses, particularly the Appaloosa, the Nez Perce had always been friends to the Americans. But with the opening of the Oregon Territory and the end of the American Civil War, white settlers, cattlemen, and gold miners came to covet the rich Nez Perce land. Ignoring their long friendship with the Indian nation, the U.S. government supported the settlers' claims. In 1877, General Oliver Howard entered the Wallawa Valley with orders from Washington to remove the Nez Perce by treaty or by force.
I did not want to come to this council, but I came hoping that we could save blood. The white man has no right to come here and take our country. And we will defend this land as long as a drop of Indian blood warms the hearts of our men.
Joseph was faced with a terrible choice: to betray his father's dying wish or to commit his people to war. Finally, he reluctantly agreed to relinquish his Wallawa Valley homeland. Despite Joseph's concessions, tensions remained high. As the Nez Perce were preparing to move onto the reservation, a youth, whose father had been murdered by settlers, gathered several friends and killed four settlers who were known to have committed atrocities against Nez Perce people.
I know that my young men did a great wrong, but I ask, who was the first to blame? Their fathers and brothers had been killed. Their mothers and wives had been disgraced. They had been told by General Howard that all their horses and cattle were to fall into the hands of white men. I would have given my own life if I could have undone the killing of white men by my people. Chief Joseph Nez Perce.
When seven more whites were killed, General Howard sent a military force against the Indian nation. Nez Perce leaders responded by dispatching a truce delegation under a white flag to meet Howard's advancing army. Howard's men opened fire. So began Chief Joseph's famous flight for freedom. Over 700 men, women, and children, with sick and elderly, enduring a 1,800-mile fighting retreat. The struggle would capture the imagination of the American public. Newspaper accounts made Chief Joseph a household name. With a military genius born of desperation, the five Nez Perce bands outwitted and outmaneuvered one military force after another as they made their way toward Sitting Bull's camp and political asylum in Canada. Circling through the mountains, canyons, and plateau prairies of Idaho, crossing the high ridges of the Bitterroot Mountains into Montana and Wyoming, colliding with frightened tourists in the newly created Yellowstone Park, the Nez Perce fought off in turn four armies commanded by veteran Civil War officers. After 105 days of constant pursuit, the Nez Perce reached the Bear Paw Mountains in Montana, one day from Sitting Bull's camp and freedom. They knew they had put safe distance between themselves and the pursuing armies and stopped for a last rest before moving across the border. What they did not know was that a new army had been dispatched by telegraph and was surrounding them as they camped. The Nez Perce were taken completely by surprise. The fighting was intense, and in the first moments, Chief Joseph and 70 others were cut off from the rest of the camp.
With a prayer in my mouth, I dashed unarmed through the line of soldiers. My clothes were cut to pieces, my horse was wounded, but I was not hurt. As I reached the door of my lodge, my wife handed me my rifle, saying, "Here's your gun. Fight."
They ran up the hill when the fighting was going to, they turned the camp down there. She had this little baby and her girl by the hand, and they said there was kind of a tree, like there was a big log there, so they crawled under that log to kind of hide from the soldiers that might come and probably shoot them down too. And they just stayed there till everything was quiet.
The battle raged throughout the first day with heavy casualties on both sides, including the leaders of three of the five Nez Perce bands. By the second day, the Nez Perce were dug in and fighting from trenches. The army could not mount an attack without heavy losses. Finally, on October 5th, General Nelson A. Miles called Chief Joseph to peace talks under a flag of truce. Chief Joseph went to General Miles and gave up his gun, only one day from Sitting Bull's camp and Canadian asylum.
"I am tired of fighting. Our chiefs are all killed. The old men are all dead. The little children are freezing to death. I want to have time to look for my children and see how many of them I can find. Maybe I shall find them among the dead. Hear me, my chiefs. I am tired. My heart is sick and sad. From where the sun now stands, I will fight no more forever.
But the United States would not honor the terms of Chief Joseph's surrender. The captured Nez Perce were shipped south to a malaria-infested reservation at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, before final relocation to Oklahoma Territory. Chief Joseph had put down his gun, but he had not given up the struggle for his homeland. He would devote the rest of his life to honoring his promise to his father and fighting for his people. He traveled to Washington, D.C., where he passionately argued his case before Congress.
I have heard talk and talk, but nothing is done. Good words do not last long unless they amount to something. It makes my heart sick when I remember all the good words and all the broken promises.
In 1885, after 8 long years and a massive campaign launched by Eastern philanthropists, Chief Joseph's people won the right to return to the Northwest, but not to their beloved Wallowa Valley. The cattlemen who occupied it threatened to kill Chief Joseph if he returned. Forever banished from his country, Joseph and 150 members of his band were taken under military escort to a reservation in Washington Territory. There, in exile, Chief Joseph would die.
The doctor that was there to examine the Joseph, his plea was that Joseph lost his life because of his broken heart.
If the white man wants to live in peace with the Indian, he can live in peace. Treat all men alike. Give them all an even chance to live and grow. You might as well expect the rivers to run backward as that any man who was born a free man should be contented when penned up and denied liberty to go where he pleases. Let me be a free man, free to travel, free to stop, free to work, free to choose my own teachers, free to follow the religion of my fathers, free to think and talk and act for myself. Chief Joseph Nez Perce.
When I was young, I walked all over this country, east and west, and I saw no other people than the Apaches. After many summers, I walked again, and I found another race of people had come to take it. Cochise, Chokonen.
When California became part of the United States in 1848, a new flow of military and civilian traffic headed west. Many, bound for Southern California, took a route near the Mexican border that went through the lands of Apache nations, the Chic'onan, Bidoncahe, Nidnai, and Chi'ene Apache. The Apache had a long and successful history of defending their lands against aggressive Spanish and Mexican invaders. But as the newest arrivals, the Americans, crossed their lands, most Apache held no grievances against them, and their leaders made every effort to accommodate the travelers.
At last in my youth came the white man. Under the counsel of my father, who had for a long time been the head of the Apaches, they were received with friendship. Soon their numbers increased, and many passed through the country. We lived in peace. Cochise, Chukonin.
In February of 1861, a charismatic Chukonin leader, Cochise, was summoned to a meeting with an inexperienced army lieutenant named George Bascom. Bascom accused Cochise of kidnapping a child from a nearby ranch.
Cochise denied that any of his band had done the kidnapping. Bascom accused the chief of telling a lie. Cochise was very proud of making his word good, and no greater offense could have been offered him. Da kluge, nid nai.
Bascom ordered Cochise arrested, but the Apache leader escaped through heavy gunfire. The men who accompanied Cochise were held by Bascom and executed soon after.
At last, your soldiers did me a great wrong, and I and my people went to war with them. Cochise, Chukonin.
Cochise cut off passage through Apache Pass. The United States responded by sending General James Carleton to establish Fort Bowie in Apache Pass.
There is to be no council held with the Indians. The men are to be slain whenever and wherever they can be found. The women and children may be taken as prisoners. I trust that these demonstrations will give those Indians a wholesome lesson.
But the long and intense efforts of the United States Army would have little success. Based at his stronghold high in the Rocky Dragoon Mountains, Cochise fought a successful guerrilla war against the U.S. cavalry for the next 9 years. Finally, in 1872, General Oliver Howard traveled to Cochise's stronghold to sue for peace. Cochise agreed to lay down his arms for a promise that his people would be allowed to live on their own land in Apache Pass. Howard's promise would hold true through the remaining 2 years of Cochise's life. Then, in 1876, the United States dissolved the Apache Pass Reservation and ordered the people to the barren San Carlos Reservation.
The Creator did not make San Carlos. It is older than he. He just left it as a sample of the way they did jobs before he came along. Take stones and ashes and thorns, and with some scorpions and rattlesnakes thrown in, dump the outfit on stones, heat the stones red hot, set the United States Army after the Apache, and you have San Carlos.
Of those ordered to relocate, two-thirds refused, preferring to follow a new generation of Apache leaders. Leaders committed to freedom at all costs. Among them were Ho, Nana, Loco, Victorio, and Geronimo.
Ho told them that he could offer them nothing but hardship and death. As he saw it, they must choose between death from heat, starvation, and degradation at San Carlos, and a wild, free life in Mexico. Short, perhaps, but free. Let them remember that if they took this step, they would be hunted like wild animals by the troops of both the United States and Mexico. All of us knew that we were doomed. But some preferred death to slavery and imprisonment. Da kluge, nid nai.
Geronimo's strength of will had been forged much earlier when his wife, children, and mother were killed in a Mexican raid on his village.
He had been away from home and came back and found his entire family scattered all over the, in the yard, dead. The Americans and the Mexicans rode horses with shoes, and so he knew that they were the ones that were, had come and destroyed his family. And he made a vow then that he would kill every Mexican and every American that he saw.
Now he would lead the Apache through their greatest test. The final Apache resistance was a monumental expression of human pride and love of freedom.
We are vanishing from the earth, yet I cannot think we are useless, or God would not have created us. For each tribe of men God created, he also made a home. In the land created for any particular tribe, he placed whatever would be best for the welfare of that tribe. Thus, it was in the beginning, the Apaches and their homes, each created for the other by God himself. When they are taken from these homes, they sicken and die. How long will it be until it is said, there are no Apaches? Geronimo Bedonkahe.
For a decade, the Apache surmounted overwhelming odds. By 1886, Geronimo's tiny band was being hunted across the mountains by 8,000 troops from Mexico and the United States.
He was losing all his warriors and his family. He could never beat them because there was always somebody there, and there were so many. And he was losing his own people. And he said, if I keep fighting, there will never be any more of us.
At that time, Geronimo's band consisted of 17 men. He had also Lozen, known as the woman warrior. Geronimo was handicapped by the presence, too, of women and children who must be defended and fed. Nobody ever captured Geronimo. I know. I was with him. Anyway, who can capture the wind? Dao Klugi, Nidnai.
On September 3rd, 1886, Geronimo turned himself in to General Miles, who had already made his reputation as the man who finally caught Chief Joseph. As a condition of surrender, Miles promised Geronimo that his band would be taken into custody for only a short while before being released to a reservation in the Southwest. But Miles lied. Geronimo's people, and even Apache peacefully settled at the San Carlos Reservation, were shipped to Indian prisons in Florida.
I was born as a prisoner of war. They promised us in the beginning that we would be held prisoners for 2 years, which went into 28 years. And I'm almost sure we're the only tribe that ever served that many years in prison.
Geronimo would not live to be a free man. After 23 years as a prisoner of war, he died in 1909.
What is the matter that you don't speak to me? Why don't you look at me and smile at me? I am a man. I have the same feet, legs, and hands, and the sun looks down on me, a complete man. I want you to look and smile at me.
By the late 1800s, reservations had become virtual concentration camps. Most were on barren lands, useless for farming and devoid of game. Indian people were forced to live off of U.S. food rations, promised in treaties in return for their lands. Providing subsidies and food for over 200,000 Indian people was big business. The distribution system quickly became a corrupt network of government agents and their partners, known as the Indian Ring.
If they bring any goods for the Indians, the agents live off of them. And pay has been taken by the agents. And they have put money in their pockets. The steamboat came in the night and took away boxes of goods so that the Indians would not know it. Struck by the Re, Yankton.
Robbing nations of their meager government subsidies, the Indian Ring left the people in abject poverty.
And they hoped, it seems to me, to take away the spirit of the people so that we become more docile, so to speak. We would then only depend upon them for the way to be. We would have to go to whoever brought out the rations.
I noticed a small group of Indians who sat under a tree. All were dirty, ragged, and lean. Soon an Indian woman and a young girl hurried into the group and laid down packs and opened them. I could see spread out there some dingy meat, evidently waste from a butcher's shop, and some discarded scraps of stale bread and other stray odds and ends of food. I felt a wave of fury toward our government's whole Indian policy. Thomas Tibbles, reporter.
Many Eastern reformers were determined to break the Indian Ring, but they believed that the only lasting solution was change, not only for the bureaucrats, but for the Indian people themselves. Indian ways were judged as backward and wrong, that for their own good, their cultures had to be erased. Indian people were to be remade in their reformers' image.
The Indians' only safe future can be found in merging their interests with ours and becoming part of the people of the United States. Their safe course is to quit being tribal Indians, to go out and live among us as individual men, to adopt our language, our industries, and become a part of the power. Richard Pratt, Director, Carlisle Indian School.
The policy of stripping Indian people of their cultures became official with the 1887 passage of the General Allotment Act. The act broke apart communal landholdings, assigning plots to individuals in an effort to force them to live like white farmers.
As long as Indians live in villages, they will retain many of their old and injurious habits. Heathen ceremonies and dances, constant visiting. I trust that before another year is ended, they will generally be located upon individual land or farms. Government Commissioner.
Supported by an alliance of Eastern reformers and Western land speculators, allotment attacked both the sovereignty of Indian nations and the fundamental concept of land belonging to all the people.
This is only another trick of the whites to take our land away from us, and they have played these tricks before. Hollow Horn Bear, Oglala.
The allotment system was ripe for massive fraud. Corrupt agents declared small children, dogs, and horses as allottees, then seized their lands and sold them. Indian orphans were shuffled off to white families who adopted them to obtain title to their allotments. After allotment plots were handed out to Indian people, the U.S. government was free to sell the remaining reservation lands to whites. During the allotment period, Indian nations would lose two-thirds of the little land that remained in their hands. 2 years after the passage of the Allotment Act, Oklahoma Indian Territory was officially opened to settlers. What followed were the famous land rushes. The territories of the Creek, Cherokee, and other nations were overrun. Lands which had been promised them as permanent, unassailable refuges in exchange for their lands east of the Mississippi. But of all the government policies designed to end Indian cultures, the cruelest was yet to come. Indian people would be robbed of even their children. Across the country, Indian children, some as young as 4 years old, were taken from their parents, often by force, and sent to boarding schools. At the boarding schools, children were stripped of all outward appearances linking them to their Indian past.
Our belongings were taken from us. Even the little medicine bags our mothers had given us to protect us from harm. Everything was placed in a heap and set afire. Next was the long hair, the pride of all the Indians. The boys, one by one, would break down and cry when they saw the braids thrown on the floor. Lone Wolf, Blackfeet.
Children were forbidden to speak of their traditions and severely punished if they used their native languages. Fed distorted images of evil Indians, many came to doubt their own identity.
I remember growing up that I never really felt good about myself. We were taught to be ashamed of who we were and who we are. And it hurts when you're young and you're trying to understand.
We all wore white man's clothes and ate white man's food and went to white man's churches and spoke white man's talk. And so after a while, we also begin to say Indians were bad. We laughed at our own people and their blankets and cooking pots and sacred societies and dances. Sun Elk, Taos.
Many boarding schools were set up in converted military posts where for decades soldiers had been trained to fight Indian people. Students slept on cots in cement barracks and were drilled daily in strict military regimen.
It was like an army barrack. They marched just like they do in the army when you first go into the army. We marched to school. We marched to eat. They took us to church. We marched to church. We lived kind of an army style life. And we went to school that way.
If we thought the days were bad, the nights were much worse. This was a time when real loneliness set in. Many boys ran away, but most of them were caught and brought back by the police. We were told never to talk Indian, and if we were caught, we got a strapping with a leather belt. I remember one evening when we were all lined up in a room, and one of the boys said something Indian to another boy. The man in charge caught him by the shirt and threw him across the room. Later we found out his collarbone was broken.
The priest would take a leather harness strap, and he would beat my husband. And every time that strap would come down on him, Howie would repeat to himself, "I'll never forget my language." He was thinking that. I will never forget my language.
The boy's father, an old warrior, came to the school. He told the instructor that among his people, children were never punished by striking them. That there was no way to teach children. Kind words and good examples were much better. Lone Wolf, Blackfeet.
Each day stretched into another endless day. Each night for tears to fall. Tomorrow, my sister said. Tomorrow never came. And so the days passed by, and the changes slowly came to settle within me. Gone were the vivid pictures of my parents, sisters, and brothers. Only a blurred vision of what used to be. Desperately, I tried to cling to the faded past, which was slowly being erased from my mind.
For traditional cultures, the effect was devastating. Boarding school graduates returned to the schools and encouraged new students, fresh from the reservations, to give up their traditions.
Don't look back. All that has passed away. This country through here is all improved. You saw when you were coming, cities, railroads, houses, manufactories. Boys, this was once all our country, but our fathers had not their eyes open as we have. Now, the only way to hold our land is to get educated ourselves. Henry Jones, Creek.
But the home cultures were not altogether powerless against boarding school invasion. Many held firmly to their traditions, and returning graduates who did not readapt found they had no place in their old world.
It was a warm summer evening when I got off the train at Tao Station. The first Indian I met, I asked him to run out to the Pueblo and tell my family I was home. The Indian couldn't speak English, and I had forgotten all my Pueblo language. Next morning, the governor of the Pueblo and two war chiefs came into my father's house. They did not talk to me. They did not even look at me. The chief said to my father, "Your son, who calls himself Raphael, has lived with the white men. He has been far away. He has not learned the things that Indian boys should learn. He has no hair. He cannot even speak our language. He is not one of us. Sanok, Taos."
These things that made life for us the most important thing, these were the things that took away from us, and today, so many of our Indian children have forgotten their language, even here on our reservation, because they took that language away from us, our language that God gave us.
When we started this series, we wanted to make sense of how a continent of some 500 Indian nations became what it is today. What we found was an ironic path. Newcomers looking for freedom and tolerance, but showing little of those virtues to the people they encountered. Many Indian nations have survived. Today there are over 10 million Indian people in North America, with 2 million in the United States alone. They no longer face conquistadors or invading settlers, but they continue to deal with a complex struggle to maintain their cultures and quality of life.
It's difficult to explain, like the native people are like a root, you know, where everything grows there. It's their community, it's their land. That's where they live, that's where they are born, that's where they have their grandparents buried, the ancestors were there. Their language is there, everything is there. And then you ask them to change their way of life. So you carry them away. I say it's just like when you try to plant a tree, let's say a spruce tree, in a desert land, even though you put water in it, it's going to dry, it's going to die.
Our people, our families had been telling us all these stories all these many years. And at last, we finally set foot and walked in the areas and slept in the country where our and grandmothers and grandfathers started from. And I can just imagine how my grandmothers and my grandfathers would have felt if they had come back like I did. And I saw those places for them. I was able to return.
I think a lot of times the general public doesn't understand where the Native Americans, their feelings of what's happened to them in the past and where they're coming from and why they're sometimes withdrawn, why they haven't really jumped into the mainstream life.
I think what present-day Americans have to learn is that our heroes are not their heroes, and their heroes are not our heroes. And when I went to school, just as you and everyone else in this land, we've all been exposed to the same value system, the same perspective on history. The lesson that's there, the very important lesson today for all people, is to realize the value of an alternative perspective. And that is why we are here. That is why the Creator allowed some of us to remain, in spite of all the attempts to destroy us. Every tribe has had their great swamp in that process. Every tribe has had their sand creek. Every tribe has had their wounded knee. The list is endless, and we've all shared in that same experience.
I went to a meeting at Wounded Knee in November when there was snow all over the ground, and we were on our way to the burial site. I could not help but think back. And there was a feeling there. There was a feeling that those that were there in the grave were trying to tell me something. And it brought tears to my eyes. And I stood there, and I there was a spirit that came over. And I could feel that spirit. It was the Spirit of God.
There is a mightier power than kings and presidents who guides the minds of the people. A higher power.
The mandates are very simple. You know, that we must live in the land that the Creator gave to us and look after His gifts so that our great-great-grandchildren will be able to enjoy the same things that we enjoy today. If we look at natural laws in a very simplest form, is that you must drink water to survive. So if you pollute the water so that you can't drink it, then you will perish. And there's no appeal to this if you violate the natural laws.
Someday, I fear that the land that we have here now will be taken, because some of the treaties state that as long as the water flows and the grasses grow, that we will be here. But our rivers are drying up, and when the water is gone, what will happen then? And what's going to happen to my children?
Our cultures have been assaulted, our lands have been stolen, but we're still here as a people. And we're fighting the same battles that have been fought for the last 300 years. They're unresolved. And it's up to us to resolve them in a fair and honorable manner. Destiny is not a matter of fate. It's a matter of choice. And we have some choices to be made here. We have the choice of continuing to survive on his planet as Indian people. That's our goal, and we're going to accomplish that. We're going to be here for many, many years to come.
Taloak of the Narragansett Nation said it was his destiny, perhaps that of all Native people, to be the conscience of America, to see that the tragedy of the past would never be repeated. Hopefully now that we've had a glimpse of the other side of the American story, we too can be a part of that collective conscience. Thank you for joining us.
On March 19, 1840, Comanche chiefs and their entourage arrive in San Antonio, Texas. They come for a council with the Texans. Inside a building known forever after as the Council House, negotiations are about to take place. The talk is supposed to be about peace, but the leaders on both sides are men of war. The elder statesman on the Comanche side is Mukwara, a respected warrior. Texas is represented by Colonel William S. Fisher, commander of the 1st Infantry Regiment and a former nominee for Texas Secretary of War. Through an interpreter, a former Comanche captive, Fisher asks the chiefs to turn over all their white captives. The colonel has no idea how many captives they hold, but he offers half of Texas in exchange. Mukwara has arrived in San Antonio with only one white captive, hoping to bargain away over a dozen others, one by one, for a better deal.
The commander wants more than that. He wants the return of all white captives, and he wants the clearing or the moving of all Indians from Central Texas. This isn't possible because Mukwara really doesn't have that type of status, and he can't speak possibly for all the Comanche groups.
The Comanches have only brought one captive, Matilda Lockhart. Abducted from her family 2 years before, in 1838, the 15-year-old girl has resisted her captivity. Her nose has been burnt and terribly disfigured by the Comanche women charged with getting her to comply with tribal life.
Anglo women taken captive, sometimes they were more mistreated by the Comanche women because they're the ones who were there and were working side by side, and Comanche women would take any type of anger out on them. So Matilda Lockhart had led that kind of abusive life.
Matilda explains that she has also been repeatedly raped and that the Comanche hold many other white captives. Colonel Fisher is informed of this.
This had racial, it had cultural, it had sexual connotations. This infuriated the Texas officers.
Through his translator, Colonel Fisher tells Mukwara that unless all captives are turned over immediately, the chiefs will be placed under arrest. The translator tells Fisher that the Comanche say they would rather fight to the death than be caged. But the colonel insists. The translator delivers the message and bolts for the door. The council house peace talks turn into a brutal melee. When the gun smoke clears, 7 Texans and 35 Comanches are dead, including all the chiefs. 30-odd other Comanche women and children are then held as hostages.
Whites felt real justified about this. The Comanches felt we're just doing our thing and they attack us. This was the problem, I think, all the way through in the tragedy of the relations between whites and Comanches. Neither ever understood the other's minds.
From that time on, Texas and the Comanche vow to fight each other until one side or the other is exterminated.
I don't think Comanches had any hesitation to kill somebody. They felt it was on the agenda.
They raided and pillaged and even more because it was payback time. And the Comanches were out to teach the Texans a lesson. They're telling the Texans and sending them a clear message. We'll go anywhere we want to please, and we'll do what we want, and we'll win.
The Comanche use what today would be called guerrilla warfare. They work best in small groups and by stealth, stealing into an enemy camp at night, taking horses, loot, captives, and killing swiftly and silently.
Well, it was not European where you go out and sustain campaigns. It was warfare Comanche style, much more a series of raiding. The white troops would look at them and being kind of amazed, and while they looked at them, they'd been punctured with arrows from all sides.
In order to defeat the growing Comanche threat, Jack Hayes, now the captain of a Texas Ranger company, learns and adapts to the Comanche way of war. His first revelation is that the Rangers must go on the offensive. And with their new Colt six-shot revolvers, the Rangers pack an indisputable advantage.
It's like two champions who are kind of going for the title fight. But this title fight goes on round after round, battle after battle, raid after raid, and so forth.
The combination of the Texas Ranger adapting this sort of guerrilla warfare, plus his practiced accuracy with his firearm made the Texas Rangers the most powerful force that the Comanches ever faced.
But they caught a Comanche camp. Jack Hayes wiped them out, and with no particular attention to age or sex. They killed them all if they could get them. On the other hand, this is exactly the way the Comanches fought the whites.
In 1846, the United States annexes Texas and inherits the Rangers Comanche problem. Within 2 years, federal troops are building a string of forts across the Great Plains, and more settlers arrive in droves. But ironically, it's not pistols, but a pestilence that wreaks the most havoc on the Comanche. First smallpox, and then in 1849, a cholera epidemic kills hundreds of Comanches.
We do not know the exact number of losses. We know they were terrible. The tribes were absolutely decimated.
Weak and vulnerable, some Comanche bands agree to move onto a Texas reservation. The Texans want the Comanche out once and for all. And in 1859, many in the tribe are forced onto a federal reservation in what will eventually become Oklahoma.
And they ran us out of Texas into Oklahoma. They killed our men, women, and children.
The change of riding with the wind to being caged was just a pathetic spectacle.
They are concerned that their entire way of life is going away. That's what, to them, they are fighting for.
Some Comanche bands resist moving to the reservation. With the holdouts is a 13-year-old Quahada Comanche named Quanah. Quanah's father is a war chief, and his mother is a white female captive. Although he is barely a man, Quanah already shows the signs of intelligence, ferocity, and commitment of a Comanche leader. On December 17, 1860, Texas Rangers and U.S. Army Dragoons attack Quanah's camp while the men are away on a bison hunt. Children scatter, and several are shot. But Quanah's mother is spared when Ranger Charles Goodnight spots her blonde hair and blue eyes. He rescues her from the village, and they learn that she has been a captive of the Comanche for nearly 25 years. She is taken and reunited with her birth family, back to the people who knew her as Cynthia Ann Parker. But separated from her Comanche family, the only family she really knew, Cynthia Ann feels she has nothing to live for. And to the horror of the Parker clan, she gives up her will to live and starves herself to death. But her son Quanah will live to become the legendary leader of all the Comanche people. In 1861, the Comanche are clinging to a shrinking empire. Years of war, broken promises, and disease have reduced their numbers to less than 5,000. For the moment, the whites have stopped fighting the Comanches and are fighting each other in a bloody civil war. Comanche peacemakers see this as a chance to make a deal that could bring a lasting peace. At the end of the Civil War in 1865, a delegation of Comanche and Kiowa, including their respected peace chief, Ten Bears, leave their homeland and travel to Washington, D.C. For the first time, they see what America has become. Ten Bears tells his delegation, "They have so much. Surely a little harsh land in West Texas is nothing to them."
Ten Bears was incredible individual because he was a spokesperson, a statesman, very intelligent, had a wide-ranging perspective. He at one point had even suggested to the government, well, you know, you've moved the Indians from the east, why don't you move the Texans? And so his way of thinking, his way of responding to the U.S. Officials was one in which, you know, the U.S. officials had not really kind of met that type of articulate person, you know, coming from the Comanches.
Proudly wearing his Presidential Peace Medal, Ten Bears returns to his people. But within months, the fight against the Comanche resumes. Ten Bears convinces many Comanche and other tribal chiefs that if they don't sign some sort of treaty with the government, they will be exterminated. In 1867, at Medicine Lodge Creek in southern Kansas, many tribes, including some Comanche, meet U.S. officials to strike a deal.
Brings perhaps the largest gathering of Plains tribes together ever. You've got Comanches, you've got Kiowas and Arapaho and Apaches. The five most dominant southern Plains tribes come into one place. They'd never met before like that.
The Medicine Lodge Treaty calls for the Comanche to give up all territory in Texas in exchange for 3 million acres in southwest Oklahoma, wagon loads of supplies, schools, and lessons on farming and ranching. Ten Bears feels he is being forced to sign away the soul of his people and lets the United States know exactly how he feels.
Well, I know he was a brave man. I know that. And he was very outspoken, and that's the way I am. I'm very outspoken, and I know I get that from him. You said that you wanted to put us on a reservation to build us houses and to make us medicine lodges. I do not want them. I was born when there was no enclosures, and where everything drew free breath, I want to die there and not within the walls.
Reluctantly, Ten Bears and many others move onto the reservation. But nearly one-third of the Comanche, particularly the younger warriors, refuse to capitulate. They don't give up land. They get guns. The firearms they seek are the repeating rifles that can shoot faster and farther than a bow and arrow. All available from sometimes unscrupulous New Mexico traders known as Comancheros. By 1871, armed and out for revenge, the Comanche are at war with the United States.
In the 1870s, the situation between the U.S. government and the non-reservation Comanches was really quite tense. The U.S. government had finally decided that it's time that we do something to control the situation.
On the Comanche side, the most outstanding leader is the son of a great war chief and the first captive white girl. He now calls himself Quanah Parker.
He was very brave. And he proved himself to be a very strong Comanche fighter.
Quanah Parker is ruthless, brilliant, and he meets his match in the new commander of the U.S. 4th Cavalry, Lieutenant Colonel Ranald McKenzie.
Not glamorous, not dynamic, not like Custer, but he was one that got things done, and he came to the West.
Ranald Slidell McKenzie, in my opinion, was the last great American cavalry leader in the West. McKenzie was the cavalry leader who finally did it for the Comanches. He, along with others, had learned to do away with sabers, cold camps, no bugle calls, pursue, pursue, pursue. This was perfect anti-guerrilla warfare.
And McKenzie's tenacity is not the only problem confronting the Comanche. In 1871, the rotting carcasses of slaughtered buffaloes start appearing all over Comancheria. The American taste for fashionable buffalo hide coats and the use of buffalo leather for machinery belting is driving the herds to extinction. The Comanche staff of life is no more.
The greatest threat to them, believe it or not, isn't even the American military. It is the bison hunters.
The primary weapon that the buffalo hunters used was the 50 caliber Sharps, which was a very powerful weapon that could easily bring down a buffalo at a great distance. One individual could kill 100 or more buffalo a day, every day, for months at a time.
Hundreds, thousands of buffalo are literally killed every day. During this time period, the buffalo being killed is killing the source of life, the source of everything that the Comanche are.
Their whole universe was beginning to collapse by this time.
It is the beginning of the greatest fight for the survival of the Comanche, a killing spree that has come to be known as the Red River War.
The event that most historians agree on as being the catalyst that really started the Red River War would be the attack by the Southern Plains Indians on the buffalo hunters that were at Adobe Walls in June of 1874.
Adobe Walls is an old Texas rest stop and gathering point for buffalo hunters in Comanche territory. Quanah leads his warriors there for revenge. But the well-armed marksmen cut down many of Quanah's band and forced the Comanche to retreat.
And these are marksmen who earn their living by shooting buffalo at a long range. And so as they attack, the warriors begin to fall. Quanah Parker is loose in this battle.
Outgunned by the buffalo hunters, pursued by a lieutenant colonel who fought like a Comanche, Quanah leads his Quahada band and their last great herd of Comanche ponies back to the one place they believe they can hold off the U.S. cavalry and return to their old Comanche ways.
It had gotten to a point that McKenzie was not going to give up. And always, as they began to do this, as they pursued the Comanche would literally fall off the earth because where did they go?
From a great distance, if you looked across the plains, it was hard to note that there actually was a canyon there. And the canyon was one of the great assets to many Comanches because it was a protection in winter. It was also a protection in warfare. The Comanches could hide many horses, thousands of horses, in that area.
This is really kind of an oasis, a sanctuary. I mean, look at it. Buffalo grazed here, and nobody could find them. That was this place.
It was hard to find. It was a great hangout, a great place to hide.
Here in Palo Duro Canyon, in the heart of the last Comanche hunting grounds, Quanah Parker and his remaining warriors hope to evade McKenzie's relentless cavalry. If not, Quanah and his warriors vow to die fighting, like Comanches. In 1874, the last Comanches to reject life on a reservation are being pursued relentlessly by the U.S. cavalry.
The Indians could not stop. They could not stop to hunt. The women and babies died. They were pushed on. They just couldn't stop because there's always a cavalry troop on them. The Comanches were really in bad shape to the point where there was only one effective war band left, and that was the Quahuarena.
The Quahuarena war chief is Quanah Parker. He and Cavalry Commander Colonel Ranald McKenzie have been playing cat and mouse for more than 2 years.
McKenzie could never really catch a Quanah Parker.
In the Texas Panhandle, Palo Duro Canyon is the last great sanctuary of the Comanche. Palo Duro is unknown to the American troops, and the Comanche have been coming here for generations, and they know where to hide within its rugged, inaccessible canyons. Quanah Parker believes that this is the one place on Earth where he will be able to elude Lieutenant Colonel McKenzie and his 4th Cavalry.
They came here to seek the face of the Great Spirit for endurance to continue and to start a beginning of a new lifestyle.
But McKenzie has an ace in the hole, an informant who leads the 4th Cavalry to Palo Duro and shows them the route to the Comanche camp. Who this informant was and what his motivation was is a matter of great historical debate. Some believe it was a Mexican trader named Tafoya who had made deals with the Comanche in the canyon. Another version of the story is told by a descendant of Bad Eagle, a Comanche who is believed to have led McKenzie right to his people in order to spare them.
He knew enough of the ways of the world to know the Comanches could not continue living in the way that they were living. The game was gone. There were white people all over the Southwest, and Comanches could not continue to be free and survive. So he made a major strategic decision for the survival of remaining Comanches.
Whether it was Tafoya or Bad Eagle, McKenzie found Palo Duro. From his lookout on the canyon edge, McKenzie can see Quanah Parker's camp and the tribe's last magnificent herd of horses. It is September 28, 1874.
McKenzie pushes his people all night. Comes down here about dawn, comes down very houseless. You know, one at a time, they come down these trails.
Charge!
The cavalry has control of the camp, and McKenzie orders his men to destroy the supplies, the food, the teepees. And then McKenzie orders his men to shoot the entire Comanche herd. More than 1,400 horses are shot dead in Palo Duro Canyon.
This seems like a very brutal type of act, but they were war material just the same as the weapons and food he found here.
But to the Comanche, the horse is more than just war material. It is the lifeblood of their tribe.
That is the most pivotal event, I think, in Comanche history, because after that, they're no longer who they were in the past. They are no longer lords of the plains, the greatest horsemen, the greatest warriors, perhaps, in the world, and after that battle, they are not that anymore.
The Comanche on foot is a pitiable creature. He can't fight, he can't hunt, he can't feed his family, he can't do anything.
The Comanche try to regroup and rearm and to find fresh horses. They make it through one more winter, but life is too difficult, and the cavalry knows it.
Finally, they send out people with the word, come in or we'll kill you all. A few hundred, I think a total of about maybe 1,000 Comanches all left. The Indians as a independent people were all finished.
On the 2nd of June, 1875, Quanah Parker and about 400 Comanche diehards surrendered to the U.S. government at Fort Sill in southwestern Oklahoma.
I don't know that they officially surrendered, but they came into Fort Sill because of the extermination policies. And for sake of survival, this was the only place that they could come.
This was essentially a tragedy. You look for good guys and bad guys, I think you're on a false trail. What you had was two peoples in collision. And I think it was inevitable if they ever came into contact with each other that they would not be able to live with each other in peace.
Despite the fact that the Comanche themselves never chose him, Quanah Parker is named Chief of the Comanche Nation by the U.S. government and remains so until his death in 1911. He is buried alongside his mother, Cynthia Ann Parker.
He felt, rightly or wrongly, but the only way that the people would survive was they had to walk the white man's road.
In a way, he escorted the Comanche Nation into the 20th century.
In the 20th century, the Comanche people may follow the white man's road, but they never lose the soul of the Comanche warrior. During World War II, they again rise to the level of their ancestors. On D-Day, June 6, 1944, a company of Comanches are among the troops that land on Eutaw Beach. Like the Navajo code talkers fighting in the Pacific, the Comanche soldiers use their own undocumented language as a code that the Germans cannot crack. Today, the spirit of the Comanche warrior lives on as Comanches find themselves on the front line of another war, fighting for a country that once tried to exterminate them.
The short answer is Comanches are good fighters. It calls forth a essence of being. It calls forth the raison d'être, the reason for why I'm here is to fight.
Past history has only done the Comanches honor. And it's a wonderful privilege to be a Comanche. Oh, I am so proud. Everywhere I go, you know, I tell them I'm Comanche. Ah, hey, na, na, hey, ne, ah, hey, ah, hey, ah, hey, hi, no, ah, hey, ne, ne, hey, ne, na, hi, yo, ah, hey, ne, ne.
I found this piece of metal in my arm.
I don't know how it got in my body.
Is this an abduction, Comanche Chief? Is this an abduction, Comanche Chief?
A Comanche leader evolved over a period of time with superior skills and superior intelligence. There was no campaigning. In fact, that would ensure that you wouldn't become a leader. Not happen.
The Comanche system of small bands, leaders chosen through valor, and their skills in defending their land works brilliantly. The tribe is not only existing, they are flourishing.
Comanches had developed such a reputation for efficiency in battle and in warfare that in spite of the fact that there were relatively very few of them, they controlled the largest hunting empire in the history of this continent.
By the early 1800s, Comanche warriors have ruthlessly driven off all other tribes who dare to invade their vast hunting ground. But a strange new tribe of white men, calling themselves Texans, begin to crowd Comanche territory. And these tough frontiersmen will prove to be a more than worthy enemy against the war-hardened Comanche. At the end of the 18th century, the Comanche are in control of a vast territory in the southern plains known as Comancheria. War is their way of life. Courage, stealth, ruthlessness determine a Comanche's rank and status in the tribe. Warriors fight for glory, loot, captives, and to preserve their hunting ground. To fight their enemies, the Comanche master a variety of deadly weapons that include the lance, the bow and arrow, and the war club. The head of the war club could be a stone or even flint, chipped to a razor's edge. It weighed only a few pounds, but gave the brave an effective weapon for close combat.
You see, sometimes people coming over this way,
Many of the work clubs were mostly swung this way, on the side. If you hit a person right, could probably kill, but most of the time it probably won't. It would probably just injure or hurt the person.
The lance, like a spear, was good for hunting and battle. Long lances were used to strike at buffalo. Shorter lances were easier to handle in combat. At first, the points were chipped from flint or stone. Later, when the Comanches came into contact with white traders, they made lance heads from scrap metal, sharpened to a deadly point. But the weapon of choice for the Comanche warrior was the bow and arrow.
The Comanche warrior, as a boy, grew up with the bow. As young warriors, young children, they were given games to play, little bows and arrows for them to always be around. So that's what made them expert shots with the bow. They were so good at it, they could shoot birds from the air.
The bow is made from ash or hickory, and its string is animal sinew. It's short, so it can be fired more easily from horseback. The arrows are crafted from the branch of a chokecherry bush. And like the lance, early arrow points were cut from stone, then later from sharpened metal.
And many of the arrows were also personalized. It had a marking of some certain type. You know, for instance, maybe a line of marking that is put on there. It means that that is for that individual warrior. That is his arrow.
We know that it would bring down a bison. That's a combination of skill between the horse, the rider, and the bow. But it would bring down a 2,000 to 4,000 pound bull. That's a pretty effective weapon.
Beginning in the late 1700s, the Comanches start trading with French fur trappers for flintlock muskets in exchange for buffalo hides. But the white man's weapons don't live up to the Comanches' expectation.
Now, they gave up guns by about 1800 because, remember, we're talking single-shot muskets. And they found that their ability with the bow and arrow was much more deadly than firearms.
Invincible on horseback, the Comanche hold off all invaders. By the end of the 18th century, they are known as the Lords of the Southern Plains. But in the late 1800s, strangers enter Comanche lands. These are not hostile hunting parties or raiders from other tribes. These are white people with plans to stay.
Whatever kind of people it was that was willing to take their wagon out into Comanche country and try to start a home, try to start a farm, those were brave people.
At first, the settlers are of little concern to the Comanche. There are so few of them, their rifles slow to load, and their horses are inferior. And even when the first American army troops arrive in Comanche territory in 1834, they pose no real threat.
At that time, the United States policy was very much towards peace with the Indians. This land out there was a great American desert. Washington was perfectly willing to let the Indians have this. For years, American troops were never allowed to go into Indian territory, even in reprisal.
But as soon as Texas declares independence from Mexico in 1836, the trickle of settlers hungry for land turns into a flood. This is an outrage to a tribe which considers the land a gift to them. In tribal councils, Comanche bands come together and decide the new immigrants must go. On May 19, 1836, a Comanche war party approaches the settlement of John Parker and his family. The Parkers and a few other groups are preparing their crop on this quiet patch of central Texas. The women and children watch cautiously. Suddenly, the men are speared and scalped. The warriors then quickly chase after the others. Parker's granddaughter, Cynthia Ann, is captured, along with two women and two other children. Indians know that settlers will pay a high price for the safe return of their kinfolk. The other women and children are eventually ransomed, but young Cynthia Ann disappears with the Comanche. News of the Parker raid spreads like wildfire. Back east, newspapers cover the story in lurid detail. Soon, the horrible stories of Comanche raids and captures are everywhere.
My 5 hours with the Comanches, my 2 weeks with the Comanches. This was popular reading. This was drugstore comic book literature at the time, and so it, sometimes it's hard to tell how much of it's for real.
But the threat is very real, and settlers in the New Republic of Texas demand that something be done about the Comanche.
It was a very bad start for both peoples, particularly the Texans. You have to remember, early 19th century Americans, and certainly frontiers people, did not tolerate easily their women folk being massacred. So what you had almost from the very start was blood feud.
Hundreds of young settlers, armed and ready for a fight, join a brand new ragtag militia known as the Texas Rangers.
Most of these Rangers, they were frontier bred, good at horsemanship, and who naturally also did not like Indians very much. There were not many humanitarians among the Texas Rangers.
At first, the Rangers have little more on their side than killer instincts. It's not enough to defeat a people bred for war.
The Ranger bands were small, almost always outnumbered. Therefore, they found the best defense was to build a legend, be very brutal, and to attack. And they developed tactics exactly like that.
Among the first Rangers to do this is John Coffey Hayes. Slim, small, and refined. Hayes doesn't look like the image of a tough Texas Ranger, but looks can be deceiving. Nicknamed Devil Jack, Hayes is smart, strong, and absolutely fearless.
What was said about Hayes was by one of the Tonkawa scouts. He said, "I'm not afraid to go to hell, you know, with my buddies. Jack Hayes not afraid to go to hell by himself."
With thousands of settlers staking claims on their ancestral land, and facing more and more attacks from vengeful Rangers, the Comanche decide to act. In February 1840, Comanche leaders ride into San Antonio to negotiate a peaceful coexistence. But what happens instead is a bloodbath.
An unusual year is very
summer 1492. After 3 months at sea, the Santa Maria, the Pinta, and the Nina anchor off the Bahamas. Europe has found the Americas. Next comes conquest and colonization by settlers who remake America in their image. They advance. And destroy. But there is another story about the animals and plants they bring here. And the natural treasures they find here. And how the Americas are completely transformed. It all began 500 years ago.
It's 1491. A year from now, Christopher Columbus will set foot on this quiet beach. What's here before he arrives is a world of unbelievable natural wealth. Two vast continents teeming with life. More than 600,000 miles of coastline are surrounded by pristine waters. Shoals so dense, they're said to slow the passage of ships. Countless species number in the tens of millions. Inland from the Atlantic shores, great forests stretch in every direction. This new world is a land of stark contrasts. From the lush jungles of South America to the glaciers of the Arctic North and the great plains of the Midwest, where gigantic herds thunder across North America, there is room for caribou, antelope, bison, and the giant grizzly. In the sky above, flocks of birds nearly block out the sun as millions of pigeons, ducks, and geese cover the horizon. No one in Europe has dared imagine the magnificent bounty that exists on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean. In 1491, Christopher Columbus stands on the coast of Spain, looking west. He dreams of leading an expedition to find a new trade route to Asia. Success will mean glory and riches for himself and the Spanish monarchy. In Europe, the nobles have grown wealthy by trading with the East. Spices and gold, gemstones and silk are the most lucrative goods. But Europeans have lost the Silk Road to the Turks, and foreign trade is in decline. The wealth of kings is in danger. Isabella, Queen of Spain, is desperate to find new routes to India, and she has a plan. Isabella is the most powerful woman in Europe, a continent of expanding horizons filled with competitive and inventive souls. For 500 years, they have been building castles, palaces, and centers of trade. Kings and popes have raised armies to fight each other and their enemies on Europe's borders. Nowhere else are rivalries so intense, gold fever so widespread, religious fervor and business expertise as tightly wound as in Europe in 1491. Ideas are moving forward. Curiosity and the thirst for power pushes Europe's limits. Europe is a busy and crowded continent, trying to feed a growing population of 100 million people. Natural resources are already exploited as land becomes scarce and overworked. Most of the peasants are farmers, working land that belongs to someone else, owned by the nobles or the church. Their main diet is bread and porridge, both made from harvesting grains. They plant rye or wheat in winter, oats or barley in the spring. And every third year, the field lies fallow to regenerate. They've learned to harness water and wind for power, It is hard work, but good for producing higher yields in smaller spaces. This agricultural revolution allows the European population to grow. With the help of one more important element. Domesticated animals. Horses pull plows. Cattle provide meat, fur, and hides. The pig is a main source of meat and leather. And so too are sheep. And mules can pull a cart. Cows also give them milk, butter, and cheese. It is not only people that domesticate animals. The big five, horses, cattle, goats, pigs, and sheep, domesticate the European landscape. They contribute to Europe's overcrowded conditions. In 1491, the Americas, too, are a crowded and prosperous place, but in a very different way. The Andes cradled a vast empire ruled by powerful god kings. Mesoamerica is densely populated and home to the most impressive civilizations on the continent. The Atlantic coast is filled with smaller villages and fields. And along the great rivers, great cities are built around monumental plazas. It is an ancient world, inhabited by 100 million people. Hunters and gatherers, fishermen and farmers, kings, slaves and soldiers. Down among the trees, where the Missouri, Illinois and Mississippi rivers merge, lies one of the largest civilizations on the continent. The native Mississippians are mound builders, occupying a vast region from the Great Lakes in the north to Florida in the south. The first explorers thought these great mounds were natural, carved by retreating glaciers. Now we know that they are the centerpieces of cities. Cities like Cahokia. Busy trading posts of earth and wood, with populations of up to thousands of people. No one knows what they called themselves or what language they spoke. But we know why they were successful. These Mississippians are farmers. Their staple crop is fuel for the ever-growing population. It is a plant native to the Americas, unknown to the rest of the world. But corn is not a blessing from nature or a gift of the gods. This crop is the outcome of man's first feat of genetic engineering. Once they learned how to grow it, they could stay in one place. This simple diet translated straight into the energy to build a civilization. The cultivation of corn is a key to flourishing cultures in the Americas before Columbus.
the staple crop in North America was corn. 6,000 years ago, ears of corn were only about as long as a person's thumb, and they were barely edible. It took thousands of years to develop a more nourishing and larger hybrid, and also a hybrid that could grow in cooler climates outside of Mesoamerica. And it wasn't until about 1,100 years ago that corn reached the Mississippi River Valley.
Corn is the result of the domestication of the wild Teosinte grass. Early Americans started with this spindly stalk, and over the centuries, they developed it into today's giant cob. Archaeologists and biologists are still debating how corn was achieved out of a tiny grass. Corn is one of the keys to understanding American civilization. Wherever it flourishes, so do great cultures. Yet the greatest American empire of them all is found where corn cannot grow, high in the Andes. The Inca Empire stretches nearly 2,500 miles down the west coast of South America. Inca build palaces, storehouses, and castles in the tall mountains. In their realm of 6 million people, they rely on manpower to transport stones without animals or the wheel. And the energy for that is provided by another amazing food source. They are famed for their gold, but their true treasure is less glamorous. A tuber, native to the Americas and unknown in Europe. Cultivated here some 8,000 years ago in the region around Lake Titicaca, in today's Peru and Bolivia, 12,500 feet up. What is now a staple food in Europe was an American invention. By the year 1491, the Inca grow thousands of varieties, domesticated from wild ancestors. Some poisonous, some even carnivorous. They preserved the tuber by mashing them into a substance called chuño. After harvest, potatoes are spread on straw and left out to freeze at night. During the day, they are exposed to the sun. Trampling them eliminates water and allows them to dry. Chuño can be stored for 10 years, providing excellent insurance against possible crop failures. The Inca carve step-like terraces into the mountainsides to stop the soil eroding and create a flat surface for their crops. Terraces absorb more sunlight than steep slopes, so potatoes can grow at the highest altitudes. And all this is achieved by manpower alone, using wooden tools. In North and South America, in 1491, farmers grow corn and potatoes to feed their people. They have none of the domesticated animals that benefit Europe. For Inca farmers in the Andes, their chief source of meat and transporting goods is the llama. This is the biggest domestic mammal in the Americas. The llamas also offer dung for the soil and hides for clothes. But they can't milk or ride them, and the animals can't pull a plow. So they are no good for farming or for travel. But their wool is a true blessing. It is warmer and lighter than sheep's wool. and produces a greater yield. The second principal domesticated animal of the Americas is much smaller. For the Aztecs, the turkey is vital. Even today, for their descendants in Mexico and Guatemala, the turkey is so important that they dedicate two religious festivals to it. Native Americans have such few domesticated animals because the biggest native mammals in the Americas died out long ago.
At the end of the last ice age, the megafauna in the Americas, the giant bison and the mastodons, went extinct. And the reasons for that are probably twofold. First of all, as the ice age was ending, the climate became much hotter and drier, and this killed the vegetation that these very large animals depended on. Secondly, the arrival of hunters into North America, crossed over the Bering Strait land bridge from Asia, coincided with the extinction of these animals. And very likely these hunters went after these large animals who were slow and had a lot of meat. And what this left in North America were animals such as bison, deer, and antelope that are not suited to domestication.
In 1491, Native American tribes hunt wild animals to survive. But the village dwellers in the forests of the Northeast and nomads on the plains develop methods to guarantee their meat supply. They can't domesticate these animals, so they find a way of making their prey come to them. In the years before Columbus, Native Americans noticed that grass grows better after being burned by lightning strikes. So they start to burn the prairies and plains themselves. Many tribes use this technique, including the Sioux, Cheyenne, Comanche, Shoshone, and the Blackfeet.
America in 1492 was not a pristine wilderness. That's a romantic myth. It was in many ways a managed landscape. Natives regularly burned the forests and the prairie in order to attract game.
Not only does burning create lush grassland, it keeps the forest open and makes hunting easier. The new rich pastures lure and increase the numbers of herbivores, as well as the predators that feed on them. They domesticate the land in order to attract wild animals. Nomadic Central Plain Indians are able to lure the biggest mammals in the Americas. The bison. Wherever they roam, bison are the main source of food and clothing and of tools made from their bones. But still, the bison thrive. By 1491, North America is home to perhaps 30 million. They reign on the prairies from Montana to Texas. Pushed east by Native Americans along a path of fire, opening up the forest into virgin land. The bison gain a new habitat far beyond their original range. Native Americans have no guns or horses. They hunt on foot. They dress in hides to get as close as possible, and hunt with the bow and arrow, or spears, all made of wood and leather, bone and stone. hunting the bison is essential for their survival. In Europe, hunting is no longer about survival. Noblemen hunt for sport, for pleasure and prestige. The nobles are allowed to hunt. If ever they catch a peasant hunting, he will be punished for poaching. Unlike in America, there's no room here for an abundance of wildlife, for endless herds. In Europe, the land is man-made. Agriculture and cities push the wildlife back. Untamed land is now a rarity. But they have one other major food source. Fish have long been cheap and abundant for every social class in Europe. Christianity, the common religion all over Europe in 1491, approves of fish. Eating meat is banned on more than 100 days a year. The demand for fish is huge. But intensive agriculture is damaging the fish supplies. Once unlimited, supplies in Europe are dwindling fast. What happened to the fish stocks in Europe?
As people started to grow crops and cut back the wild woods, this released huge amounts of sediment into the watercourses, which changed them from being fast, clear-flowing rivers and streams into slow, turbid rivers and streams. And the freshwater fish found a problem with this, particularly migratory species that came up from the sea to spawn in rivers, animals like salmon and sturgeon. There was another factor which also cut down the supplies of these migratory fish, and that was that people started to build dams along rivers, and when that happened, the migration runs were blocked and the populations declined.
When supplies of fish dwindle in their polluted lakes and rivers, they turn to the sea. For the first time, they set up large-scale sea fishing. They find abundance on a scale never seen before. They exploit it. Cod and herring from the North Sea are the first to be fished. Every 5 years, catches double. By 1300, thousands of tons of dried fish are exported from Norway to Britain alone. But this is 1491. Europe's rivers and lakes are now dirty and empty. And surrounding seas are fast becoming depleted. In the Americas before Columbus, fishing is not an industry. They don't need it. Fish are for the taking. Their rivers are not used for power and are not affected by farming. Native Americans transport their fish far away from the coasts and waterways. Into the interior, high up into the mountains. The Inca, high in the Andes, enjoy fish from the Pacific. The Mississippians trade with communities as far away as the Great Lakes to the north and the Gulf Coast to the south. They even eat fish and seafood from the Atlantic. Here, too, there is space for abundance. The waters teem with fish and with whales, dolphins, and manatees. Wherever Native Americans trawl their nets, they find a bounty of thousands of different species. Menhaden, channel catfish, and sheephead. They never have to take more than nature can replace. North and South America appear to be a primitive, untamed paradise. But looks can be deceiving. The greatest numbers of freshwater fish live in the Amazon, the largest river in the Americas, and the most voluminous in the world. To our eyes, the Amazon rainforest is an almost untouched Garden of Eden. But it was once a very different place than what we know today. When the jungle was cleared in the 20th century for agricultural purposes, people found the remains of a sophisticated civilization that once managed this landscape. In 1491, this area is home to thousands of people. They tend orchards with all kinds of fruits: papaya, mango, cocoa, nuts, and palms. They speak many different languages and live in many different social systems. Their tightly packed settlements cover an area of over 46,000 square miles. They are linked by raised causeways, bridges, and canals. Much of this is natural savanna created by annual flooding. But they have expanded the grasslands, regularly setting huge areas on fire. By 1491, they have created an ecosystem of plant species adapted by fire that cannot exist in nature. Eventually, the jungle will reclaim it. Further north, in what is now New Mexico, another grand civilization has already come and gone. It flourished in a place that today looks like no humans could ever have lived there. The Chaco Canyon. There is almost no vegetation, no water, and no animals to be seen. And it was already like this in 1491. But once, this area looked completely different. This is the story of a civilization that developed as far as it could, used its resources as well as it could, and still declined. Chaco Canyon was once covered with lush vegetation and forests of pine and juniper. The fertile area was home to the Anasazi. From the year 700 on, the Anasazi built the highest and largest buildings in North America. One is several stories high and has 600 rooms that overlook the majestic canyon. 1,000 people lived here. They had no animals to transport materials. Thousands of felled trees were dragged down to the Chaco Canyon on men's bare backs. There is no written account of their lives or of their disappearance. But environmental historians can tell us what happened by counting tree rings and analyzing rat nests. Nathan English of the University of Arizona spends much time in the canyon looking for traces of the ancient nests.
Our interest in Chaco Canyon is to learn more about how the ancestral Puebloans live, and there's a number of ways we can do that. We can do that through traditional archaeology where we dig up ruins and sites, or we can also look at what the environment was like around the ancestral Puebloans. And the way we do that is by looking at pack rat middens. And each pack rat midden is like a little snapshot in time of the area around the midden itself. So you could think of it like a picture. And the middens can be up to 40,000 years old in some places. And what the midden is it's the pack rat makes a nest, and it poops in that nest, and then it only gets its water from eating plant vegetation. So its urine is very thick and viscous. That urine seeps into the pile of poop, essentially, and solidifies, almost like amber. In the meantime, the pack rat is also collecting things for the plants around it, also pot shards, sometimes even corn or seeds of squash. And those macrofossils are incorporated into the midden. So we go out, we collect the midden, and then we examine the macrofossils in that midden to look at what the ecology around that midden was like at that time.
Not only do rat middens hold information, trees do too. Scientists count the rings of ancient logs to give the exact date when the very last tree was cut down. The Anasazi used juniper and pine for their timber and fire. Too much of it, some think. With the trees goes the soil. The forest cannot recover. Because of erosion, water drains down, creating gullies on the way. Irrigation and agriculture are no longer possible. This large population cannot feed itself anymore. But did they destroy the forests, or did the forests leave them?
We are on the edge of this pinyon juniper woodland, and so it's really possible that just natural climate change would have caused it to move back. But it's also, we know that the people were harvesting wood for fuel and for timber, and so it's likely that a combination of the two things are what led to the loss of forest in this area.
The year 1130 rolls around. It is one of the driest of years. The Anasazi have survived previous droughts, but the population has increased greatly, and there is no suitable territory to expand into. Without rain, it's impossible to grow enough food to support the population. No agriculture means no culture. the Chaco Canyon is abandoned. These ancient Americans cut down the last tree and move on. Over in Europe, in 1491, they are cutting down the forests rapidly. Their growing population needs more food and more space in which to grow it. And they badly need the wood. They have the tools. They have the means to transport it. And they have the energy. But they're beginning to run out of space and time. Only wood can help them to move forward.
The Middle Ages were the era of wood. You find it wherever you look. Wood was the most important material for building, for making tools and furniture, and for burning. It was the only fuel. There was hardly any coal.
It is an era of competition, and wars use up forests too. Whole armies are equipped with bows made from yew wood. The yew tree is almost exterminated in Europe. Armies need iron weapons, and smelting ovens burn day and night. At the same time, whole forests are used to satisfy another European craving, for magnificent buildings. The cathedrals in the cities are made of stone, yet they require millions of logs for their bases and frames. Larches are needed for roof supports. Solid logs of oak, alder, and elm are sunk into the ground to create foundations. Wood is indispensable for pillars and ceilings, posts and roof panels, axe handles and cartwheels. European castles, cathedrals, monasteries, and churches consume entire forests in Germany, France, Italy, Spain, and England.
No wonder that all the great social and economic struggles in the Middle Ages are fought in the forests, around the forests, and about the forests.
In this competition for timber, those who have money make the rules, and the money is now in the cities. Perhaps the richest city of all is Venice. It's built on wood, literally. Piles sunk into the mud to create the platform on which the great stone facades can float. But behind all this is commerce and a great maritime republic. The goods that are bought and sold are transported in wooden galleons. Venice has denuded the forests all around them to build its fleet. The city's demand is insatiable, and they start to deplete the Alps. Spruce for masts, larch for planking, elm for capstans, walnut for rudders, and most importantly, oak for hulls. When that is not enough, they cut a swath across Europe all the way to the Baltic. The Europeans have exploited their natural resources, leaving a continent where there are few fish in their rivers and less timber in their forests. Their towns are crowded with people, and they don't know what to do with them. Rivalries between princes and kings have grown intense. Religious fervor, curiosity, and greed are widespread in 1491. And there is a constant hunger for new ideas. The printing press is invented. Books and ideas spread. But where do they go from here? Where can all this raw energy be channeled? This is the time when European kings and queens send explorers beyond the horizon to expand and enhance their power. Some explorers go around Africa to find the sea route to India. One has the vision to sail west to arrive in the east. He is a seaman from Genoa, Italy, a fervent amateur who has the crazy idea of sailing into the unknown to reach India. Christopher Columbus has spent 5 years trying to gain royal support to finance his voyage. Isabella, Queen of Spain, finally agrees. What does the Spanish crown have to lose? It doesn't cost much to finance 3 ships. Spain has so much to gain from a shortcut to India. Treasures, trade, and land. At first, no one wants to board his ship. Finally, he drags together a motley crew of 87 men. Many are illiterates, petty criminals, even murderers, who choose probable death at sea in preference to the gallows. Many are soldiers, with nothing to do since Spain expelled the Moors just months before. Now, they are soldiers of fortune. With his band of desperados, Christopher Columbus sets sail from the port of Seville. It is the summer of 1492. He promises the Queen that his expedition will be a success. And in a matter of weeks, he will change the course of history. It is October 12, 1492, when Columbus sights land. I saw neither sheep, nor goats, nor any other beast. All the trees were as different from ours as day from night, and so the herbage, the rocks, and all things. 3 Spanish ships sail west for 3 months in search of India. Then finally they arrive, 87 men, among them conquistadors, pig farmers, murderers. But this is not Asia. It is an island in the Caribbean. They have no idea that they have come to a new world.